Hi, this is Tundibar Gatkins, and this is episode 32 of our Treasure Island Pedagogies podcast, today from the Center of Innovation in Education at the University of Liverpool, where we share our lightbulb moments, teaching props and pedagogies as we cohabit our Treasure Island, the space for contact time with students. I have the pleasure of introducing three guests today, Claire Stokes, Jenny Blake and Rod Woodhouse. And can I ask each of you to briefly introduce yourselves, your disciplinary background and anything else you want to mention? Claire, can I come to you first, please?
Sure, yeah. So I'm Claire Stokes. I am the Head of Academic Practice and Development in the Centre for Academic Innovation and Development at Chester University. Still tripping over that a little bit because I'm 2 weeks into that post. Immediately before Chester, I was at BPP University, which specialises in professional higher education. So a lot of our academics there have come straight from industry or practice rather than through a kind of traditional academic route. So that's quite an interesting context. At BPP, I was the leader of the Postgraduate Certificate in Learning and Teaching and kind of took the lead on all of our advanced HE accredited provision, similar at Chester with a slightly wider remit. In terms of my original discipline, so way back when I did my undergraduate work, it was in English literature, and then my doctorate was in American literature. Which I taught also a little while as a graduate teaching assistant while I was completing my doctorate.
Great. Thank you very much, Claire. Jenny?
Hi, everyone. I'm Jenny Blake. I have two substantive roles at the University of Manchester. The more substantive, I guess, is I'm head of teaching and learning development at the University of Manchester Library, which means I look after any of the times we're teaching students or, in fact, staff, anything about the library, its collections, or the support services that we run. So we do all the skills support centrally for the university. I'm also academic lead for student success for our Institute of Teaching and Learning. And that remit is a bit wider. It includes things like welcome and academic advising, but the idea there is that they both are quite closely linked as roles, and they're really just about either supporting students directly or supporting our staff to support students in their success.
Great, thank you, Jenny. And Rod?
Hi, I'm Rod Woodhouse. I'm a lecturer in the Department for Health at Bath University, and I work on our distance learning postgraduate taught programmes. So that would be the sports medicine, sports physiotherapy and football medicine programmes, where I'm the academic programme and digital learning lead. And I am also a lecturer on our professional doctorate in health programme as well. I ended up in health in a slightly circuitous way. I started off in maths. So my undergraduate is in maths. My postgraduate is in psychology. I then ended up in the School of Optometry in Cardiff University, teaching a variety of different things. And then I left Cardiff and came to Bath. So I've gone progressively more qualitative as my career has developed.
Great, lovely. And I love that everyone is wearing many hats and so many ranges of lovely context for students and learners in general. So thank you very much. And as you know, we will talk about lightbulb moments. So can you share some lightbulb moments you've had with your learners, students, in whatever of these contexts they may have been?
Do you want me to go first?
I'll jump. Go on, Claire.
So it's interesting because whenever anybody asks about light bulb moments in teaching, there's always one that really, really stands out to me. And it's from way back when I was teaching American literature to first years. But then there's been a more recent light bulb moment, I think, for me in teaching on postgraduate certificates. And actually, I think the two of them are connected when I was kind of reflecting mm-hmm. on these two different moments. So the first one, when I was doing my doctorate, I was teaching an introductory module on American literature. And all of the students who were doing American studies had to do this module on American literature, whether they liked literature or not. It was kind of compulsory as a kind of introductory thing. So we used to kind of take them through, and really the idea of this course was not so much about the text per se. We did kind of big canonical American texts. So there was some, The Scarlet Letter was on there by Nathaniel Hawthorne, Rip Van Winkle, these kind of big canonical texts. But really, it wasn't about that. It was about trying to introduce them to critical analysis of literary texts. That's really what that was all about. And one of the students one time, he'd finished the module, and he said to me at the end of the module, Miss, because he always called me Miss, I don't know why, I think it's just because they were kind of straight out of school, but he said, Miss, you've ruined reading for me. Oh. And actually, what I think he meant by that was, he couldn't kind of just sit on a beach and read a book anymore and kind of just enjoy the story, because he'd been exposed to this much more kind of disciplinary way of engaging with literary texts and thinking about, okay, well, what's the social context for this? What's the historical context? And kind of, you know, analysing subtext and all that kind of stuff. So I thought it was really interesting the way he said it was quite funny the way he said it. But I thought, you know, he's moved from this very kind of experiential way of reading is just like, well, I read this and it's a story, this common sense understanding of how we engage with literary text, to a much more disciplinary way of engaging with the literary text. And then later, when I became more involved in kind of academic development, I thought, well, that seems like a really clear example to me of a threshold concept in Landon Mayer's terms. So this student had kind of said, I've crossed this threshold and I can never go back, and it's changed. I've got this disciplinary way of thinking and practicing, and that's changed how I engage with text. So for a long time, I used that as an example of a threshold concept. And then more recently, I've been teaching on PG certs in learning and teaching for quite a long time. But the cohort at BPP was a little bit different to cohorts that I've worked with before. So these professionals who were coming into higher education, again, bringing a kind of common sense understanding of teaching. So I think people think, you know, I was taught since I was five. I've seen lots of teaching. I've experienced teaching. I know what teaching looks like. I know what good teaching and bad teaching looks like because I've experienced it. So they could come onto the PG cert and I think feel like they had an understanding of what teaching is and what it involves. And then one of them said to me recently, we were getting towards the end of the module, and she said, I feel like the thing that I've learned from this module is there's loads more to teaching than I realised. And I feel like, you know, I didn't know what I didn't know. And I thought, again, I think this is one of these threshold concept moments where this person had realized that teaching isn't just about kind of standing up in front of the classroom and talking about, you know, your experience as a solicitor or as a nurse, but it's this theory informed practice, that there's all of this underlying stuff that she was becoming aware that she wasn't aware of. So for me, that was another of those kind of light bulb moments for her, but also for me in understanding how people experience maybe those threshold concepts as they move from common sense understanding or based in experience to, you know, a very disciplinary way of thinking about the topic. So those were the kind of two that really sprang to mind when I was thinking about light bulb moments.
So I'm really appreciative that Claire started by ignoring the command to pick one, because I also want to pick two. And I realized I didn't say anything about my sort of background. So I also have an English Lit degree. Yay. And I have a master's in education from the University of California at Berkeley. And interestingly, that master's was deliberately designed to sort of create disruptive teachers. I know we don't always think of ourselves that so much of teaching is like classroom control, right? But it was explicitly there to create people who would push against heteronormative, patriarchal, sort of institutionalized systemic issues and things like that. And so I got to read lots of bell hooks and Paul Freire, and it was amazing. But that came directly out then when, for one of my light bulb moments, another one is a while ago. I was teaching year 7 in the States. So they were, 12, 13, still old enough to get sarcasm, sweet enough to want you to like them. It was like my sweet spot age. I loved that age. And I'm very not tall. You can't tell because this is only audio, but I'm not very tall. So they were all taller than me. And anytime I sat down, I literally disappeared. I was quite young. you couldn't find me in a classroom. And so at one point, some students sort of asked a question to the front of a room, because like that's what you do if you want an expert answer. They sort of turned, because they're 14, turned to the front, just like announced a question or something. And then another student being 14 thought, oh, here's an opportunity. And they stood up and answered the question as if they were the teacher, which I clearly gel with this age group. So I thought that was very funny. They were also correct. So everyone kind of looked at me and I was like, oh, I don't know that. I mean, that's right. And we moved on. And I just remember thinking, that's it, though. I mean, learning's not about who one person having the only answer. It's about all of us sort of establishing what we need to know in that moment. And that, that kid had it then. And I've carried that kind of feeling of like, it doesn't have to be me. I should always think about how it might not need to be me with me throughout my whole career. And I also do a lot of teaching now on what's called our new academics program, things like that. So I deliver one session that looks at the way we create relationships, pedagogical relationships with our students, and carrying that like, right, does it have to be us kind of feeling with us? So I was talking to them about Gravit and relational pedagogy and inclusion and elements of that. And I was just kind of trying to push them to think about, look, we are all trained to be the expert in our extremely niche, often very specific area, which means that anytime we get a question, we start answering it from that enormously weighty position. But actually, when you're talking about relational pedagogy or student partnership, I think one of the telling elements of true partnership is equity of discussion of an idea, right? Of reaching for an answer together. And so I wanted the people in the room to consider, when they were talking to students who had a question, instead of just answering, to think about how to arrive at a conclusion together deliberately, not because they've been so practiced at teaching, they down to instinctively, but like to plan to do that on purpose. And a huge group, sometimes these classes are quite big, so there must've been about 6 people in the room, but they all did that thing where you freeze, and then they were like, oh. And then like, there was a lot of nodding. And I remember thinking, oh, I just told all of you, you don't have to be the most, like the only one who knows the answer in the room. And you've all agreed with me, which is amazing. Because there is a moment where you think some people do want to raise their hand and push back on that idea. But I really did see everyone go, do that, or actually that sounds relevant. So I think it really does connect to Claire's kind of idea around how we interact with our spaces and our teaching. And I also like this element where we're always questioning, like, how pedagogy and praxis work. And I think that's an element of teaching that perhaps doesn't get highlighted enough. Like, it's never finished, you're always recreating it in the moment.
Brilliant. As you say, as that connects with Claire's idea as well, and both are really good examples of the aha moment. I almost feel like I was in your classroom feeling that, and as Claire said as well, that moment of transformation and realization that's so evocative. Rod, what about your light bulb moment?
Not sure whether I should follow the crowd and pick two, or whether I should be the standout guy and just go, no, I'm gonna go for once. We'll see how it goes. So this is back when I worked in Cardiff, because I was working with undergraduate optometry students, and these were second year students were the ones I taught this particular class with. So I worked with a colleague, Andy Millington, who unfortunately can't join us today, but he's here in spirit because I'm here. And we would teach professional awareness. And the idea was we would teach it together. And Andy, being the optometrist, would teach the clinical side, and me, not being an optometrist, would teach the patient side of it. And we double-handed it all the way through this. And the idea behind the sessions was to get students to start thinking about themselves as professionals, not as students. So it hooks in very nicely with what Jenny's talking about in terms of we handed a lot of the power over to the students. And it was a case of, we are not telling you how to be a professional. That's for you to decide. And I'm taking a very long time to get to the point here. I'm very sorry. The main session that always stuck out for me, and there's a number of different reasons, but the main one I would focus on is one we did on professional personalities. So we'd get students to do a personality test to start with, and then we would discuss the results and just get them to understand the flaws of personality tests. And then we would say, okay, here are the results of two personality tests. Person A is quite extroverted and quite low in neuroticism. Person B is almost the opposite. They're quite high in neuroticism, they're quite low in extroversion, and everything else about their personalities are roughly the same. How are you going to cope with these two people as your patients in the testing room? And then Andy and I would double hand it, and they might say, we'd have to get the very sociable person to shut up. And then I'd say, okay, yeah, how would you do that? And we might have to get the very talkative person to actually speak. Yeah, great. How would you do that? And then we'd make a big play of the big reveal. The big reveal was, these were both my personality test results. I'd done the personality test twice. I did it first as a professional, and that was the very sociable, extroverted, not particularly anxious version of myself that I presented to the students. And the other one was me outside of work, very introverted, quite happy being stuck on my own in a darkened room, very neurotic. I was slightly upset it wasn't as highly neurotic as I thought it was, but that was always the running joke. And the key learning message is, when I started as a teacher, I knew my real personality wasn't going to work. So I had to take the time to craft that professional personality, and took the control of how I presented myself to my students. Therefore, as optometrists, you can and you should do the same. And like Jenny was saying, you got that sort of rush in the room where everyone just went, oh. And it was, hooking back to Claire as well, that was their threshold concept. It was the point at which they would stop becoming a student and go, okay, well, I can decide what I want to be. I feel really uncomfortable in day-to-day life, but I can essentially hide it, for want of a better word, and make do with that. So that was one of the, and I knew there were a number of times in those professional awareness sessions where you got the light bulb moment. And I can always remember one student who I won't name, just for anonymous sake, who was quite in the first year would have been your normal Jack the Lad type student, and then the second year wanted to knuckle down a bit. And I can pinpoint the exact session in January where he had his light bulb moment, and that was absolutely wonderful, because that was about the only time I could physically hear the ping as the light hit above his head in one of these sessions. And he just went, I get it now. This all makes perfect sense. And you could, the pieces slotted into place. And the wonderful thing was, from that point on, he was like a different person. He really grasped this concept of professionalism is really important. So to such an extent, when he was in the third year, he came back in the second year to help teach us these sessions, and it was fabulous. It was brilliant. So it was the appreciation of someone else's light bulb moment, I think, is very important as well.
I think that's really interesting as well. Just listening to Rod and Jenny, you know, this thing of what we bring from different professions that can like shed light on how we teach or how we develop as teachers. So, you know, Rod's idea of, you know, there's a professional personality or a kind of persona that you have and that you can create and that you can kind of choose how to present to learners. And I think that's quite empowering sometimes for people who are quite new to teaching, that, you know, they're kind of grappling with that idea of who they should be for their students. And if you can kind of say, well, it's a version of yourself and you can choose that version, and maybe some of these, you know, some of the tools that get used in other professions to help people to think about how to present as a professional in that area could also work for us. And I think, you know, what Jenny was saying about how that experience as a teacher in a school, you know, thinking, reflecting on how that experience, she then uses that when she's working with new academics as an example to draw on. I think it's so interesting sometimes that people who do have that professional background don't necessarily bring it through enough, maybe, into kind of who they are as a teacher. I think there's so much potential for that. So it was just really interesting for me hearing the two of you talk about those kind of experiences that you've translated over.
Yeah, for me, it was the like the interrogation and the tools to do that interrogation of like, what space and place and act am I inhabiting in this moment? And I think when we leave it to people to imitate what they've had, so like copy the teaching that they've received, either only the good stuff or like trying to not do the bad stuff, whatever it is, they're not metacognitively aware. You know, they're just imitating without understanding perhaps the pedagogical reasoning, or if that person also was just imitating. And where I view teaching, even for people who aren't going into teaching, one of the things I think is so important is giving people that capacity to create their own aha moment. Like, it's not reliant on me creating a session or on them being in a room with me, but it's in fact them going, ah, like, okay, so I can be jovial. I am another person who would score quite different on any kind of however accurate personality test. Like, there's the teacher persona who's like, hello, we're all here. And then there's like the rest of me, which is like quiet all the time. So I think it's really interesting you brought that up. But I also think it's so important that people not feel like it's something they put on, right? But something they understand and they develop with a purpose. And I think when we talk about teaching and pedagogy on our like desert island, and that moment when you're with students, it's about them interrogating what's happening. And that helps them identify what they don't know. When Claire was like, I now know I don't know all this stuff, right? Those are the tools that make you go, oh, wait, there's a gap. I don't know why this happens. And start looking for, you know, the reason why, or talking to the people or things. And so I thought it was so interesting that came up, that sort of interrogation of who I'm inhabiting now and the power I have to choose with reasons, you know, with sort of some kind of pedagogical, hopefully, root, you know, with that, in that decision-making moment.
Yeah, no, I guess maybe from how you talk as well, that you might be using different strategies, or different strategies may work for different people, or maybe different contexts and moments. So I think in Rod's example and the other examples as well, sometimes those moments are for the individual students, irrespective of if they're in a classroom, but for that student at that moment, but maybe it happens for others at other moments in other circumstances. So I think that links, Jenny, what you said as well, that there may be a multitude of ways, and our role is perhaps to help us create as many of those moments, whether they are a group experience or individual as well. So we started talking about teaching props and pedagogy. So let's sail to our islands where we are having these light bulb moments with our students. What teaching props or pedagogies would you like to bring with us in our boats or ships or submarines, however we get to the islands, that we can then use with students to have these moments?
I'm gonna jump in here. I've been trying to think about this, and I'm kind of going through, you know, I was going, should I take the entire concept of constructivism, because I love being a constructivist? Could I take that? How would I pack a concept into a trunk? I'm not sure I could. So it needs to be something more tangible.
I think it's an imaginary narrative, so we can do whatever we want.
I'm going to have a whole room full of constructivism then. We'll call it the constructivist suite, something
we
like
can
that.
Build a little corner on our, or just store it on our sails for some, and just glue it on or something.
So that's where I was going. And then I thought, maybe something more tangible, so I bring one of my model brain or my model skull or something like that. But given that he was going to join us here and he's not able to, my teaching prop is going to be my colleague Andy, because he and I were an interesting double act. Let's put it that way. And I think some of the best pedagogical moments I ever had were teaching with him. Mm-hmm. And it taught me the value of effectively team teaching, mm-hmm. but doing it when you've got both voices in the room. And that was a role we fell into very easily. This idea that, okay, I will represent one thing and Andy will represent the other thing. Andy is the clinician, I am the non-clinician. Andy is chaos, I am order. All of these sorts of things. He's the creative one, I'm the structural one. All of this sort of issue. And I think that to me was probably the most powerful teaching I ever did, was in collaboration in the room. And it just happened that Andy and I had known each other for years beforehand, and therefore we were quite compatible. And I'm not sure, and I've never captured that elsewhere. Mm-hmm. The idea that you're essentially two halves of the same coin. Mm-hmm. type approach. I think if I'm going to Pedagogy Island, I think I would just be completely lost without him. Or I'm more likely to wander off down strange avenues. Actually,
so can I ask about, on
I'm
that
less
role,
likely
then?
To go down strange avenues if without Andy, actually.
So can I ask another question? Because also in your light bulb moment, you mentioned about this dual role that you have in teaching. And then also, but in your example given when you were talking about the dual personality and how students, you're giving that sort of agency to students to decide, but also to make them think about that duality. So the mm-hmm. introvert, extrovert, and so on. So is this relating to the discipline you're teaching, whether that duality is useful, or this yin and yang approach, or is it more to do with your teaching approach or something else?
I think I would say it's more to do with the teaching approach, because mm-hmm. ultimately when we're teaching higher education, whether it's undergraduate or postgraduate, we want students to accept that there is now a grey area. There is no, or depending on the discipline, perhaps there are no definites. Two and two always equals four. But, you know, going to Claire and Jenny's examples of English literature, there are multiple ways of interpreting a given piece of literature. And that duality, that idea of, I can see both sides of the story, I can see from multiple viewpoints, is key to, or I would argue anyway, that it is key to developing their criticality. Mm-hmm. Because you have to leave your particular viewpoint aside at some point and go, okay, well, I'm going to look at it from the other side. And there is, if we look at discourse in the media, that is missing massively. You're either right or wrong, and it's always right or wrong about issues for which there is no right and there is no necessary mm-hmm. wrong. So yeah, I would say that duality mm-hmm. is a functional teaching method.
Great.
Not necessarily discipline specific.
Great. Okay, so we have team teaching, constructivism on the board. Anything else?
So I love that we keep reinterpreting your questions for you.
Brilliant.
So because I kind of want to bring a whole classroom. So Rod made me think about how learning is a social act, like even asynchronously, right? We learn best in connection with others and with the knowledge we have and the prior knowledge everyone else has. And so if I was thinking, I think I'd written flip charts and pens before, and that was basically making sure there are other people to fill them out, essentially, behind that in the room for my prop. But I think what you need is that network. I think learning is one of those things that we're told, and told stories about, like individual geniuses and the man usually who discovered the thing. And there's no story about like all the people who were around that discovery and lots of times like substantively contributed to it. And I think we're not transparent and clear enough with our students about that element. So often they go off and try and do it by themselves. You know, they view independent learning as something that happens in isolation. They view discovery as something that only counts if you can own it. And if I was going to bring something with me to an island where that would sort of like help anchor me in terms of my teaching, it's that sense of collectivism and community, where we learn better when we're doing it together. Like my example, when your student can take the front of the room, and then effectively there is no front of the room. You know, there's something going on right now, led by Mahabali and others, called Intentionally Equitable Hospitality. So they're leading a series of sessions online in May, right? And they're happening now. And one of the videos was about, I can't believe I've forgotten their name, we can put it in the blog, that there's a leader in every chair. You know, this idea that the capabilities of the students we have are as near to infinite as to be, you know, that's just a number or a concept you can use. So what I'd like to bring with me is like that sense of network and possibility that only comes from an emergent kind of, you know, a flexible community where people are entering and exiting and contributing where they can and listening where they need to. And it all really pushes things forward in a real positive way. And I think that might be where you get your nuance that like Rod was bringing up and your criticality. It's by being part of that network. So I'd bring everyone. I'm ruining the island. It's going to be very
No, well, it's not a deserted island. It's a treasure island.
Yeah, yes, even better. It's infinite resource.
It's grow with however big it needs to be. So, yeah.
There we go.
Claire, what about you? That's brilliant.
I did as I was told, Tunde. So I've chosen a tool. Yeah, so it's a bit of a Marmite one, and I kind of know this because whenever I talk to anyone about this tool, you get people who are super enthusiastic and want to hear all about like what you've done with it, and other people just their eyes glaze over and, you know, it's just like, ugh, no. So it's Microsoft OneNote, which I've used. Rod's giving me the, ugh, no. So I've used it in a couple of different ways. And I think, you know, just as Jenny was talking, I was thinking about, you know, all these different ways that we ask learners to engage with learning as independent learners and collaborating with others. And, you know, some of the challenges that we have, certainly in the classroom at the moment, and kind of go back to COVID and probably before COVID around monitoring engagement, keeping students engaged, how we check that they're on track, particularly when they're at a distance, particularly maybe in asynchronous learning settings. So I think OneNote actually can help with a lot of that stuff. I think people don't like it because it isn't as intuitive as other Microsoft tools, because there's like a desktop version and a online version, and you can integrate it with Teams, which is really great, but then that adds a layer of complexity. So it does take a little bit of YouTube videos I found really super helpful in mm-hmm. helping me to understand how to use it, and also trial and error, getting someone else to sit in the student's position and kind of me going, share your screen, what can you see, is this working, you know, trying to figure out what's not working. So it is a time investment, but I think it does, you know, you can have it as an individual, as a portfolio tool. So as a teacher, you can use it to drop resources in. It's multimedia, so you can put documents in, you can record straight into it, you can drop videos in, you can drop emails into it. You know, that this, it is literally, people talk about it as a ring binder, don't they? Kind of an electronic ring binder. And it is very like that. You know, you can slide things in and separate it. So I've used it in two main ways, I guess. One is as a portfolio tool for people who were on the academic professional apprenticeship in a previous institution that I worked at, because it meant that each of those individual learners could have their own version of this ring binder, but the course team actually could see across all of the ring binders. So we could dip in and we could put things in and we could monitor their progress and we could look at them, look at the portfolios alongside the learners. And then more recently, I was a bit inspired by some work that a colleague or a couple of colleagues had done. So Scott Farrow, who's now head of digital, I think, digital education at Edge Hill, and also Rochelle O'Brien, who I think you've had on a previous Treasure Island Pedagogies episode. They'd done some work around escape rooms. So I used OneNote to create an escape room for our postgraduate certificate, for the induction stage of the postgraduate certificate. Because again, some of the induction wasn't as naturally engaging and thrilling as it could have been. So we used it to kind of engage them with some of the policies they needed to read and the professional standards framework, getting them to understand that. And we could monitor their progress through it by, you know, have they got the code? Have they progressed to this next section? Is someone stuck anywhere? So we built a kind of a nice linear series of rooms. Actually, it was a series of escape rooms using OneNote, which actually worked a lot better than I thought it would. I was expecting lots of people to get stuck and there to be lots of technical issues, but I think my YouTube videos must have done the job for me. Me, it's a bit of a pedagogic Swiss Army knife, and I thought that was in keeping with this idea of being on a treasure island.
Brilliant. Go on.
I think that's so interesting, though. Like, first of all, well played getting good at OneNote. I am one of those people who's like, no. But I like an Obsidian MD. So, like, I have no excuse, which is another. It's basically the same thing. It's just a bunch of pages you can turn into a notebook. So, but what I was thinking that's so interesting is how we can use these tools to, like, shape, or how these tools shape and reflect our practice, you know? Because I love the idea of an escape room on OneNote. Like, that's a way for our students to engage with each other and with technology. You know, it gets a lot done, doesn't it, all at the same time. And it also asks us to, like, test our comfort levels. You know, going back to what I said before, when a lot of teaching training, at least for when you're going to be in front of a classroom of teenagers, is about classroom management. You know, like, they have to behave, and they behave in this way. And then a lot of discourse in higher education is around, what are our graduates like? Like, what's this mold we're going to shove them through while they're here so they come out the other end all the same? And I think actually what's coming out now is how many differences there are and how okay that is, but how then you have to deliberately be okay, you know, with a element of chaos or potential technological difficulties, or having your partner in crime not there all the time for Rod. And it's just one of those things, but it makes it different every time. And I think, you know, teaching is, it's almost a gift that way, you know, for those of us who would be easily bored. It's never the same. Even that aha moment, you could deliver the same teaching and it feels different because it's got different people in the room with you. So I just thought it was really interesting. I am quite intrigued by the escape room.
There's some good stuff. A few people have used OneNote for escape rooms. There's a few kind of nice papers out that you can have a look at. But it did, yeah, it worked well. It surprised me how well it worked. So I'd recommend it.
I think I might even I, who dislikes working with OneNote immensely because of the headaches it causes our students. That's intrigued me enough to make
you see. I'm sounding an extracurricular island coming together when Claire is going to show you how she's used OneNote for escape rooms.
I think we're gonna, or Claire might be some sort of criminal mastermind that's going to imprison us all with OneNote, knowing we don't like it now. So I'm a bit worried, but I really took to Jenny's point about getting out of the comfort zone. And I think some of the most rewarding teaching experience that I have had, and I suspect Claire and Jenny will say the same, is when I push myself out of my comfort zone and I've gone, do you know what? I don't know what is going to happen, but I'm going to have a go. I'm just going to test this. I don't know if this discussion is going to work, but let's try it. And I think we need more of that in education. I mean, partially that's down to the fact that I'm becoming more and more disenchanted with didactic teaching. And that is how you get away from didactic teaching. You challenge yourself and go, okay, is there a better way of doing this? And I think that also links in with the points we were raising earlier about building that community of practice, which is very difficult to do if you're just talking at people. I'm not sure I'm contributing a huge amount to this.
You
particular
are, because you
discourse,
are already.
But it's all
sorry.
Sort of germinated and ruminated in my head a little bit, and I'm now having to deal with the discomfort of the fact that OneNote might actually not be as bad as I think it is, and therefore I might need to just get over it.
Well, do your dual thinking about yin and yang and whether OneNote can be used or not, maybe that's the next step. But Rod, you were already getting on to the bartering idea. So in a sense, I was going to ask next of can you see each other barter with each other, or maybe we could, we have the ship already with constructivism, Andy as a teaching bot, so team teaching, community, flip charts and pens, and then the OneNote. Is there anything else that you want to put on this ship to bring in addition? But I think there's already some bartering going on around OneNote and community as an approach.
Are we bringing food? I think that's probably quite a good idea.
Yeah, I think we can class food as essential because I'm going to ask you about luxury next. But food. Okay, is there any specific food that you would like?
If any of my ex-students are listening to this, they are massively unsurprised that I've said food, because every single one of my examples is always food-based. As long as it's not... it's not going to go off on a hot desert island, so I'm not bringing ice cream or anything like that. I think any food will do me. Be fine.
I was wondering, there's a woman named Adrienne Marie Brown. She did a community organizing in the United States, and she's written a book called Emergent Strategy, which is amazing as long as you're comfortable with biological metaphor, like if you're comfortable people being compared to trees, which obviously people's mileage varies. You know, some people do not feel like a mushroom, etc. But if you're comfortable with that kind of elaborate metaphor, it's a beautiful and really powerful book. And when you said, is there anything else you'd like to bring? I always want to carry this with me. It's a reminder of the things that you can do, that you can only do together. Right, that group of people, that there'll be a unique experience and a unique outcome from coming together, but also that like every little thing changes something. And I'm terminally online, for which I deeply apologize, so because your audience will laugh, but including having a Tumblr account, which will date me. And what I think is so interesting about Tumblr is just people flailing around learning everywhere there. And one time I saw a post that was like, look, everyone worries about going back in time and making one small change and wiping out humanity. Nobody worries about making one small change today. Like, we have no concept of the impact of iterative change in the moments that we're making it. And that Emergent Strategy book helps remind me of that, like, you can keep moving even if it doesn't feel like you're going very far. And I think if you're on an island, not obviously ours is a treasure island and it's imaginary and we can do whatever we want, but there is a sense, I think I'd like to keep that sense of movement, you know, of growth and things like that. So I think I'd like to put that in there too.
I love that, because it also links back to the students' movement, and when we were talking, the light bulb moments that we experience, that they never stay the same as well. And that, I think that's obviously a measure of a good educator as well, if that movement happens. But I love that. Yeah, I love that. Okay, so time to relax now. You've been all busy teaching or educating others. What helps you relax? You can bring a luxury item to help you do that to the island.
I feel like Claire has to go first because we all wanted hers. That's like the basis for all the bargaining.
Okay, I'll go first. So yeah, so the absolute way that I relax kind of outside of work and stuff is exercise. And I suppose I've always been kind of into exercise at various points, but definitely kind of in the pandemic when everybody was kind of at home, Joe Wicks was my go-to kind of guru while I was at home. And I've kind of carried that on post-pandemic and got much more into particularly exercise classes. And I think for a couple of reasons I like the exercise classes. I think one is that I was kind of having a moment of reflection and thinking about, you know, why do I enjoy this so much? And I think one of the reasons I enjoy it is because I'm a little bit addicted to cardio, really. So it's not yoga and stuff. I like to sweat. I like to be, you know, I like to know I've exercised. But the other one for me is because the classes that I do are quite fast paced. It means I can't think about anything else. I have to just be in the moment and just do what the instructor says. So it's kind of constant instructions, do this, do this, do this, repeat this. So I just love that kind of 45 minutes to an hour of absolute, this is all I'm doing. So I'm not trying to work and think about if it's parents' evening or if the dog needs feeding or any of that other stuff. It's just that time to focus on that one thing, which I really like. And I think the other thing that I enjoy about it actually is I often find myself kind of thinking, oh, isn't it interesting how this instructor motivates us and how this one does it differently to the other one that does a Tuesday night class, Sunday morning class is quite different. And it's going back again to, I think, some of the points that have come up about the same class can react differently depending on whether it's a Tuesday morning or a Sunday morning or, you know, and that kind of unpredictability that you can't, you've never got it nailed down, you know, as a teacher. There's always going to be a new problem to solve. And I think that's one of the really interesting things about teaching is you can't necessarily anticipate what that challenge is going to be or what the solution to it might be. And it's, you know, speaks to Jenny's thing about we keep moving forward and we keep looking for those iterative kind of changes. So thinking about how the different teachers interact with the class and also reflecting on why I like the live classes more than the virtual classes. And, you know, so I find it kind of interesting to think about how that feeds into kind of what we know about teaching and learning. And, you know, I find myself, like I like Helen King's work a lot around developing expertise and becoming a professional. And she talks about, you know, one of the ways we do that is through deliberate practice. And I vastly improved my swimming through deliberate practice because I kind of went and I went, okay, I've watched again YouTube. Now I'm going to go and practice.
I see you here.
Yeah, now I'm going to go and practice my front crawl and I'm going to think about, you know, this particular aspect and I'm going to practice it for an hour. So I knew I was engaging in deliberate practice. So I think it's just interesting how that all kind of fits together. You know, you see yourself learning and you think you can see, going back to my light bulb moment, you start to see those theories in action and kind of see how they actually work to support learning, which is was quite interesting. So, yeah, so I said, can I bring a personal trainer with me, please?
Yeah, for all those really good rationale you've given, Claire, definitely.
Thank you.
Yeah. Anyone else? So, but I loved how in your example, you really never truly relax as an educator because you're watching and, but no, I think the release comes from the, as you said, that you have you're just gaining a completely different perspective and experience and almost like go back to your learner self, which again, can enrich your practice as an educator to really release yourself to become a learner and go back to that. Can really then help. So yeah, I love that. Thank you.
I'm also an exercise person. I'm quite lucky. I have a horse, and so I probably want to bring him. I'd be quite sad if he wasn't there, but could be convinced to bring my Kindle instead, which I'm very dependent on, to kind of pick up and put down. And when you said about like being a learner again, that's a lot of times where I go to when I have reached a point in my network, you know, when working with others where I need just a little time, and it's a luxury now, sadly, that kind of time. And so I'll find a book, not even a book always that has anything to do with what I'm wondering about, you know, but sometimes I just need to have words, you know, to focus on some words and concepts in order to almost let my brain in the background unpack, you know, whatever else it is I'm thinking about. I will almost always find something to connect. I rather famously in an interview once for a post talked about how analyzing poetry is essentially data. And I also had qualitative experience, but like, I was quite good at analyzing poetry. So they definitely wanted me running this massive institution-wide research project. But I would assert that again. And so I do think that, as Claire was noting, like some of the techniques and stuff you use elsewhere, and this has been a thread the whole day, can apply to your teaching, but I feel like that practice comes from everywhere. So for me, you know, reading is another place for that deliberate practice of attention and consideration and connection. And then I can come back and feel like I can contribute again, or I'm ready to listen to more, or whatever it is when I'm learning with my community. But yeah, I think I'd hope to bargain for Claire's personal trainer, and I'd bring my Kindle and with a magic Wi-Fi connection so we could download all the books we wanted.
I would absolutely. Yeah. There will be points when I would not want the personal trainer and I'd much rather read a book instead. So yeah, definitely.
Rod, what about your luxury item?
I'm just sitting there thinking I don't want anything to do with a personal trainer. I'm just going to find a nice place to sit and just do my usual vegetation. For me, I'd want something that I could use as a tool for reflection to help me digest what's happened, and also to switch off, like Jenny says, and just think about stuff. So I would bring a deck of tarot cards, because I'm trying to learn the tarot at the moment as a tool for reflective practice, just to drive reflection. I could carry on with that, and it pushes me out of my comfort zone. Coming from a very scientific background, I've become more and more enamored with reflective practice, and it would help me continue that learning journey. And I guess I would probably barter for the Kindle. Perhaps I would threaten to let Andy loose and get him to start talking about the really weird stuff that Andy talks about, unless I got hold of the Kindle. That's probably what I would do. I'd probably do some sort of blackmail. Maybe I'm the supervillain in the group rather than Claire. I'm not sure now.
I'm really intrigued by this idea of using tarot for reflection. Like when I saw that was going to be your luxury item, I went away and did a little bit of kind of investigation, because I thought that's not how people necessarily think about tarot cards. But I thought that's a really interesting idea, that they could be used as a prompt for reflection. So yeah, I would definitely be interested in learning more about that.
Yeah, I mean, Rod, can you give us just a little bit of a snippet of how that might work?
Yeah, so there's a couple of different ways of doing it. The way I'm going through, and I'm learning that because there's various meanings behind each particular card, and for me my process is randomly pick a card, look at it, and I know what the meaning is, and then I think, okay, how is that relevant to what I'm thinking about at the moment? But you could also just entirely base it on the picture as well. You don't need to know anything about the symbolism, and you can just say, okay, because you have an immediate reaction to this picture, and it could be this person looks sad, or it feels desolate, or there's joy, or any sort of reaction, and then that makes you think, okay, well, what am I joyful about? This guy looks like he has a problem. What about, you know, have I got a problem with something I maybe need to think about? And if nothing comes, then you stick it back in, shuffle again, and pick another one. So it's. There is my idea with using with reflection is a prompt, and this does fit in with some models of tarot reading, that it's just a prompt, and so that's how I would do it. Mm-hmm. Just in a bit of downtime, just go, okay, quick shuffle, randomly pick something, and does that help me at any point? If not, pick again. And if I go through all 78 cards, I think there is, then clearly I wasn't that bothered about the problem in the first place. But I guess that's how I would do it.
A bit like those oblique strategy cards, you know, the Brian Eno ones that are like, turn it upside down or whatever. Only they're very word focused. So I love the idea of an image, because that's the word that's coming to me is flexible. That somehow seems to be to have more depth in its prompt, you know, than a very directive one like those the oblique strategy cards are. I also hadn't heard of it like Claire, so it was quite cool.
I mean, I guess as Jenny and Claire, with your English or American literary background working with narratives, it probably flows quite naturally that there is sort of a narrative structure to spring ideas from and things like that. I can also maybe see some ideas of merging them with the escape room somehow. Anyway, the opportunities are endless. Any final thoughts? Any final luxury items? Or there's food. There is exercise on this island. I can imagine the river, sort of the symbol for forever changing, Jenny's idea. Any final things? But I think this we've got quite a nice island here with horses. So thank you very much. I think it's time to sail away. We've made ourselves a perfect island where we can go back to our learner selves as well and have lots of light bulb moments with our students. So thank you very much for our audience. Thank you very much for our audience for listening. If you enjoyed the episode, please subscribe to our podcast. To join as a guest, you can also find our expression of interest form on our LiveUni CIE podcast website, where you can also access the blog posts for all the episodes. And goodbye for now. And finally, a big thank you to our guest today. Goodbye.
Thank you.
Bye.
Thank you.